Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday. I am Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
And today, Fred, we're going to talk through the latest Creation magazine. It's the spring 2010 edition. And boy, is it chock full with a lot of great scientific information.
Oh, it is. And again, it's the number one publication I recommend to people interested in creation.
And we should give a plug tonight at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. They're going to have one of the world-renowned experts on the Shroud of Turin as your speaker tonight. And I'm going to try to be there. Are you going to be there?
I'm going to be there. His name's Dr. John P. Jackson. He'll be speaking on the Shroud. And that's at Bethlehem Lutheran Chapel at 2100 Wadsworth Boulevard.
So Wadsworth and 21st. He's one of the experts who was actually there in Turin and working with the Shroud itself. And he's a U.S. Air Force Academy guy. And so this should be fascinating. Now, the Bible does say that the linen strips that the Lord's body was wrapped in, that they were in strips, and that there was a separate cloth around his head. And when the tomb was found empty, the handkerchief or cloth around his head was laying aside, and the linen strips for his body were laying in another place. And so that, to me, suggests that the Shroud, regardless of the physical evidence, is not actually a covering garment for Jesus after he was crucified.
Yeah, it'll be real interesting dialogue, because I know that there are several members that will be asking the same questions you are and challenging Dr. Jackson to, you know, explain some of these things that don't seem consistent with the biblical account.
But what an honor to have him come to this event. It's going to be a lot of fun. John P. Jackson tonight
at 7 o'clock, Wadsworth and 21st, Bethlehem Lutheran Chapel.
Super. So now, Fred, Creation Magazine, the current spring edition 2010, they start off with this little article about dinosaurs. And it turns out, according to the Journal of Zoology, that dinosaurs were not nearly as heavy as they've said for the past 100-some years.
Looks like they were off by about half.
By about half, which is interesting because, you know how people will believe an evolutionist, a paleontologist? They'll take one tooth and they'll say, this tooth proves that there was a hominid species, an ancestor to mankind called Nebraska Man. And we're like, you could tell that all from one tooth? They say, oh, of course we can. Then they dig up the rest of the skeleton, and it turns out it's a pig's tooth.
It's a pig's, an extinct pig type
so
of pig.
It wasn't a hominid species. It was a pig. Well, remember we did the story just a few episodes ago where they reduced the number of dinosaur species by about half? Because they were basically sloppy in categorizing dinosaurs. Now they find out that when they use the same formula to estimate the weight of living animals like hippopotami and elephants, they get way too big, too heavy creatures. So they said the Apatosaurus lucei, for example, they used to say weighed 38 tons. Now they're saying it probably weighed 18 tons, which is half of the old estimate.
And you know what they used to call the Apatosaurus?
What?
The Brontosaurus.
They did, didn't they?
Yeah, that was another mistake they made.
The Brontosaurus, because they put the wrong skull on the wrong body and all that. And so it's just removing the curtain, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. We're removing the curtain to see that these paleontologists, they often do sloppy work, and once something sloppy happens, it stays sloppy for 100 years. And even when the proof is there that they're making mistakes, they continue to teach kids in school false information, and they hide the evidence for the Creator God.
That's right. It reminds me of the Haeckel's embryos. Yeah, they still show that. I mean, this is one of many examples they get things wrong, and it takes forever for them to correct it.
Yeah. So, Fred, one evolutionist said, in fact, this was, I think, Darwin's bulldog. He said that if nature ever had a wheel or a magnet, that would prove evolution is not true, because you can't have a magnet help survive unless it works, and so it could never form gradually. And he said the same thing with a wheel. Well, it turns out that as we look into microbiology, it is so sophisticated. We have wheels and gears and magnets and all kinds of stuff. Now, your field is software engineering, right?
Yeah, software, firmware engineering.
Yeah, and so IBM is looking at microbiology.
They are. They're looking at DNA and the language in the DNA, the programming language, and just the ability of DNA, how efficient it is in such a small size, because, you know, they're trying to make microchips smaller and smaller.
Right.
And they realize, hey, you know, the incredible compactness of the cell, the DNA and the programming system in the cell, the storage capabilities, it's so minute. What's really interesting is when you look at a cell, it gets more complex as you dig deeper in.
Right, right.
Take a look at a microchip, and it gets simpler as you look at it, as you get deeper in.
And so a cell, we have trillions of cells in the human body. They're so tiny you can't see them. You need super powerful microscopes to see inside the cell, and then you get to the very tiny center of the cell, which is the nucleus. And inside the nucleus, you have the DNA molecule that has 3 billion base pairs of amino acids, 3 billion chemical letters of the DNA information code.
That's right, with semantics and everything. It's a programming language.
It's like the
English language in a way. You know, it describes how to build something.
Yeah, and they used to think they were sort of getting it and that most of it was junk DNA. And now they're saying, let's not use that term junk DNA anymore. This stuff is way more sophisticated than we ever imagined.
Yeah, they keep finding function in areas that they say is junk.
Yeah, imagine IBM wanting to design their next generation of microchips after something that's 95% junk. I don't think so. All right, so Fred, let's continue. That, of course, was an article in the current issue of Creation Magazine, put out by CMI out of Australia, Creation Ministries International. What is the next article you'd like to highlight?
Well, one I really liked was this thing about spider silk. It's like a super muscle. And what they note is the silk on a spider web is 100 times stronger than steel.
Now, wait a minute. Come on. How could that be? It's stronger than steel.
Those little spider webs.
It turns out that if you had a rope made out of spider web and it was about the thickness of a garden hose, it could lift up not only a Boeing 737 aircraft that was full with people and luggage.
Two of them.
One rope, the thickness of a garden hose, could support the weight of two full Boeing 737 aircraft.
That's amazing.
That is amazing. Yeah.
Well, in this article, they go on to note something additional they've found out, because this is something reported a little bit earlier in Creation Magazine about spider silk. But another thing that they've recently discovered is that something happens when there's contraction,
when
it gets wet and damp.
And it dries. When they get wet and they dry, there's contraction, right? And expansion.
So what they equate it to is like a 2 centimeter thick rope. So imagine just 2 centimeters
thick.
Under contraction would be able to lift, and not just support, but also lift a 2-ton truck off the ground.
Wow.
Not just support it, but actually lift it. That's amazing.
Yeah, so God is quite the designer. I always wondered when I was a kid, here's a spider web. I want to get rid of it. I got a garden hose, and I'm shooting it with water, and it's not moving. Like, why isn't that spider web getting blown away by this spray of water? It's just staying there.
Yep.
And I didn't realize it was stronger than steel.
My worst nightmare was when I ran into one of those things, especially Missouri. I lived there for 5 years.
We have a lot of friends listening in Missouri. Yeah. But you're referring to how muggy it gets.
Not only hot and humid, and bugs. Yeah, and then when you're walking outside, you walk into one of these spider webs. I do that all the time when I go out there.
Yeah.
And you're wondering where that guy is on you, somewhere on your head or something.
Yeah, somewhere it's there. And in Colorado, it's so dry that a benefit is we have very few bugs compared to many states in the country. I really like that about Colorado.
And you wouldn't believe how beautiful a spider web is in the light. We had one on Halloween by pure accident. People were coming up to our door for Halloween, and they were making comments about our really neat-looking fake spider web. I'm like, hey, I didn't do that. That's God's design right there. That's a real spider web.
Wow, beautiful.
I didn't notice until one of the guys.
Amazing.
Yeah, one of the kids said at the door, that's a really neat fake spider web. Now I can tell them, oh, by the way, that's stronger. That's 100 times stronger than steel.
Yeah, and you know, kids could collect those spider webs and make a collection with black construction paper. Fred, when we were in Seattle, my boys Josiah, Nathaniel, and I, we found this massive spider web, and it had a big wampin' spider that was its home. So we went and collected another spider. We thought, what would happen if a spider ended up in another spider's web? So we threw that second spider into that big wampin' spider's web, and the second it hit the web, the home spider started to move because he knew something was there, but the other spider froze as stiff as a stone. He was not going to move. He knew where he was. He knew any vibration on that spider web, and he was done for. So he stayed there, and we stayed and watched this thing for an hour. And toward the end of an hour, that littler spider thought, I'm getting out of here. And he just took off like crazy, and that other big spider went after him, but he got away.
He got away?
He got away.
But did anybody turn you into pets? People for the ethical treatment of spiders.
But some other insect wouldn't have known that mechanism, and they would have just struggled and fooled around and would have been toast with jam.
You know what's interesting about spiders? You know, you talk about people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Yeah.
Well, do spiders feel pain if that big spider would have got the little spider?
No.
Yeah, we have evidence for that, don't we?
We have evidence that they don't feel pain.
That's right, yeah.
Well, they don't have a soul spirit.
Yep, that's right.
And you need a soul spirit to sense that something is wrong. Pain is awareness. They're like little machines.
Yes.
They're machines.
And the evidence we have is, I think they were able to make a dragonfly eat part of itself.
Oh, so there's I missed that.
Yeah, so there is scientific evidence to support that.
Wow. Okay, so what's the next story you'd like to do in the Creation magazine?
Well, right below that one is this thing about dinosaur footprints they found on a beach.
Oh, yeah.
Fossilized on a beach.
I've been on a beach.
So that must have happened over millions of years, slow process of burying those footprints or fossilizing those footprints in the beach.
Well, yeah, you're being funny because when you go to the beach and you leave footprints, they're gone usually within minutes or hours. By the next day, your footprints are gone because of the wind and the waves and other creatures. And so for these dinosaur footprints to fossilize on a beach shows what we see with all of these billions of fossils, that they were made and covered up rapidly in sediments because these were part of the global flood that happened on Earth.
Yet evolutionists will tell you there's no evidence of a global flood. I don't know how many times I've heard that over the years.
No evidence of a global flood, despite the billions of dead things laid down by water in sedimentary strata about 3/4 mile deep all over the earth. Aside from that, and fossils of sea life on the tops of the major mountain ranges. Aside from that, there's no evidence. But, Fred, there's an article in
here. There's tons of evidence for a flood on Mars. I knew where you were going.
Yeah, that's right. There's an article later in this magazine, if we could just reference it. It's about Mars, and they have two pictures of two planets next to each other. Mars, which there's no liquid water on Mars, as in less than one drop. There's no liquid water. And the Earth, which is massive, and it's covered 70% by water, and that water is kilometers deep.
That's right. And yet many secular geologists agree that there were huge floods on the planet Mars, the one that they show on the left.
Right.
That's pretty dead.
Global floods, they even say. Global floods on Mars that doesn't have a drop of water, but the Earth, which is covered in, if you flattened out the mountains and made the solid part of the Earth just an even sphere, then the water on the surface of the Earth would be 3 kilometers deep. That's a lot of water.
That's a lot of water.
And they say, oh, there could never be, there's no evidence, there could not be a global flood on Earth. But on Mars, yes, there was. It cracks me up, Fred.
It does. It shows you how silly their worldview, their thinking is on this.
Yeah, so there's evidence everywhere we look in the world for a global flood. And it's a lot of fun to see that the Bible, the story of the Bible, is true.
And not only that, in 2 Peter, it said that people would be willfully ignorant of a global flood, and and that's the case here. There's so much evidence for it. Mm-hmm. It's plain as day, and yet they'll look at a dead planet that looks like a dirt ball on this picture here, and they say there's massive global floods on it.
And there is evidence, and it is fascinating that there was water on Mars. We could talk about that on another show. Walt Brown does, I think, the best job of explaining all that. But if we could, let's go to the next story in the Creation Magazine Spring 2010 edition about the birds that we know, Fred, that little birds migrate over thousands of miles. They leave Alaska and they're going to Hawaii, somewhere they've never been, thousands of miles away, and they make it even to the same beach that their parents had left from.
That's right. And in the particular example you gave, there's no islands in between. This is, gets into another topic that maybe I'll get into, but it's amazing. How do they know where to go to get to such a precise location? Good luck. You look at a globe and see how much water there is between Alaska and Hawaii, and how small Hawaii really is in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, and how small these birds are. And, of course, they have to be efficient with energy, so they fly in a V form.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. That's the part where, how do they even make it there? Because scientists realize they shouldn't make it there.
They don't have enough of energy to make it to fly from Alaska to Hawaii, but because they take advantage of the aerodynamics of the V that they fly in, the lead bird takes the brunt of the friction. And so after his time in the front, then he rotates to the back of one of the legs of the V, and then another bird takes turns, and they keep rotating, and so they make it.
Yeah, what scientists found that without flying in a V formation, they would fall 500 miles short of Hawaii. By flying in a V formation, they would actually have an extra 500 miles they could go past Hawaii.
Wow, it's just extraordinary how God has designed. And how did that evolve, you know? Before they figured out they needed to do this, they're going to all be dead on their first trip back to Hawaii.
This is besides their ability to even know where they're going.
Right,
so
right.
That's a separate issue. You have to solve that problem first. So once you just solve the problem of, you know, having enough energy to make it there,
you got to be able to find it.
That's right.
It's like a needle in a haystack. When you're in the Pacific, I mean, I've been in a boat out in the ocean. Whoa.
I've been in Greeley and got lost.
In Greeley. I remember looking for North America. I mean, I would be happy to just spot any part of North America. We were in the Pacific having fun out in a boat off of Newport Beach, and we're trying to get back. We're looking for North America. But these birds find Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific.
Well, yeah. And, you know, my Greeley story is true. I was lost, and I actually ended up going down the wrong way on a one-way street. It was like midnight, and a cop pulled me over. And I thanked the cop for pulling me over because I'm like, would you please tell me how to get out of this town?
Right.
And he didn't give me a ticket because I was so convincing. I was frustrated.
Yeah, you were lost.
I somehow got lost.
So these birds, they used to think that the birds had magnetite or some kind of ability to sense a magnetic field in their beaks. But now researchers think they proved that that's not true. How did they do that? How did they disprove that?
They disconnected what they thought was the sensors from the beak to the brain.
Yeah,
they did
nerves.
Some snipping.
That sounds painful. Where's PETA when you need them? It sounds a little rude, but they snipped the nerves that go from the bird's beak to their brain, and they're still able to get to where they're going. So they thought, well, it can't be sensors in their beak. It must be something else. And so then they found out that birds that have lesions in their image sensing part of their brain, those birds cannot migrate.
So basically what that's saying is that they see with their eyes the magnetic field.
They see the magnetic field.
Wow.
Now that's intense.
That is.
And we would think, hey, you can't see a magnetic field because we see this tiny sliver of the magnetic spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum of what we call visible light. That's what we see. But we can make telescopes that see a broader range of the spectrum. We could see heat when we use FLIR, forward-looking infrared vision systems. And so God could design the bird's brain. We talk about a bird brain, pretty sophisticated. The bird's brain to see a magnetic field if indeed these researchers are correct.
Yes, and you know, there's another article in this magazine about how the intelligence of birds, it looks like they may be even smarter than chimpanzees. That's going to be pretty tough for the evolutionists to explain.
Yeah, because they think that we've evolved from chimps, and that's why we're so smart, because chimps are the smartest creatures. Yeah, right. Chimps, it turns out, we've been doing stories to show how dumb chimps are.
Yeah, they're pretty dumb.
I mean, I admire chimps, but compared to human beings, they're dumb.
Yeah, so there's a story about a parrot in this magazine that or parrots in general, and they're finding out a lot of things about birds and their intelligence. Mm. It's amazing. One scientist believes that they're almost on the equal par with a with a 5-year old that's how intelligent they can get.
Well, and whether of or not course, that's ridiculous.
That's obviously stretching it. But
yeah. Maybe that scientist has never had a 5-year old.
That's
because our 5-year olds have been incredibly sharp. So, Fred, let's continue. In the Creation magazine, there's an article here on snow that I just absolutely love, because evolutionists will point to snow and say, oh, see, evolution could happen. Look, it's snow. It's just the laws of physics. And you get these incredible star-shaped snowflakes. And so there you have it. And, Fred, I like talking about how beautiful snow is. The photos all over the internet of snow, it just blow your mind, especially at snowcrystals.com. Fabulous photos. But when we have man-made snow, like up at Keystone or wherever in Vail for skiers, that snow looks so pathetic.
Really?
You got beautiful snowflakes that God made, and you got this pathetic man-made snow. I mean, it works. You could ski on it, but it's nothing like God's snow.
Wow, that never occurred to me, but I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, and if you want to know, you know, sometimes you pick up snow and you make great snowballs. Other time, the snow doesn't really want to pack together. Have you noticed that?
I have noticed that, but it seems like when it doesn't want to pack together is when I want to throw a snowball.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it turns out, based on the temperature and humidity, we get different kinds of snowflakes. And you know the beautiful stars that we see? Those six-sided stars?
Yeah, on the snowflake?
Yeah.
When you see, like, pictures of them?
Yeah, exactly. Well, those star-like crystals, they grow in warmer air generally. Then when it gets a little colder, then you get these little prisms that don't really have those star points. But then when it gets colder again, as you get below zero and all, then you get the star shape again with the six arms. And then as it gets colder again, you get prisms.
Wow.
So the shape changes dramatically. But here's what I love, Fred. They say that the evolutionists say, well, look at how sophisticated. And some of the photos in this magazine are just stunning. These just absolutely stunning snowflakes. And they say, well, look, that proves that evolution could happen because, yeah, the DNA molecule is stunning, but look at the snowflakes. And here's what they don't realize, and this has been pointed out by the chairman of physical chemistry at the University of Manchester in England, and by so many other scientists. They pointed out that when you look at information on a printed page, like we're looking at this magazine right now, the arrangement of the letters on the page has nothing to do with the chemistry of the ink and the paper. Nothing to do.
That's right.
As though if you use a different kind of ink, instead of getting a comedy, you get a tragedy. That's not true. The ink may work better or worse, but the chemistry of the ink has nothing to do with the story of the book you're reading.
That's right. Nothing to do with the information content.
Nothing to do with it. So that the information content is completely separate from the physical medium that is delivering the information to you. Well, with a snowflake, that's not true at all. The snowflake is directly caused by the properties of the H2O water molecule. The water molecule properties are determining the design, the shape of the snowflake. And so information is so completely different than from the growth of a crystal or a snowflake, which is based on the physical laws.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a great article.
And evolutionists do love to try to use snowflakes as evidence of complex design. It's just like when they try to stretch microevolution to macroevolution.
Yeah, exactly. And Fred, God gave us a creation that when it gets cold, snow that falls, it protects plants and little creatures from the harsh, colder weather temperature above the snow. They live under the snow.
Oh, we used to have two Alaskan Malamutes that we bought a doghouse for them. Well, that was a waste of time. And whenever there was a blizzard, I'd see two lumps out in my yard.
Yeah.
And then when I'd go out there, I'd call their names. The lumps would all of a sudden jump out of them and there'd be a dog.
Isn't that great? And in a lake, God made ice. He made water. Most things, when you heat them up, they get larger. Most things, right? Heat causes things to expand. not water. Water expands when it gets colder. So water gets colder, it freezes into ice, which expands into greater volume, and then ice floats. If water behaved like everything else, the ice would sink. But water does the opposite. The ice floats, so lakes freeze from the surface on down, protecting all the life in the lake so it can survive through a harsh winter. Otherwise, the ice would form from the bottom of the lake, work itself up, and all the fish would be exposed at the top of the lake, and then the lake would freeze solid, and they'd all die, and we'd lose freshwater fish in much of the earth.
That's remarkable where you see design everywhere. I mean, this is an example you just gave I've never even considered, but it's remarkable thinking about what you just said. It clearly shows design.
Forethought, design, the hand of a loving creator who made us.
Absolutely.
Fred, we're almost out of time. And so tonight at Rocky Mountain Christian Fellowship, Wadsworth and 21st, 7 o'clock, the Shroud of Turin. That should be fun.
Absolutely. Dr. John P. Jackson.
Yeah, and so that's at 7 o'clock in youngearth.org. You can find out all about it.
That's right. And next month is Stephen Austin.
Stephen Austin, the geologist who did the video, Mount St. Helens. He'll be there, and he's going to do a field study at Red Rocks on the next day, on Saturday. So these things are going to be so much fun. But Fred, in our last minute, before the show started, I talked to you about the difficulty of Bob and Yurt Live. We have extreme financial difficulty. And I don't like to be the boy who cried wolf and say, this is it, we're going to go off the air. But you were here, and we got a serious call from our bookkeeper, and we are unable to pay our radio bill. Unable.
That's right.
And our telethon in February, which is designed every year to pay for our radio bill for the next year, we thank God for the people who gave, but overall, it completely failed to raise that revenue. We were busy getting the signatures to get Amendment 62 on the ballot. That succeeded, but Bob and Yurt Live is at risk of going off the air.
That's right. And I know you're not very good at, you know, making pleas out there, but we really do need your financial help.
Yeah,
to keep this show and keep all of Bob Inyart live on the radio.
Yeah, there is a crisis, and if somehow we get through the crisis and we're on the air on Monday by some extraordinary effort, it's not as though the crisis is over and BEL will be fine. We struggle, and we need help. So if there's anybody out there who could help, and I'll tell the audience this, Fred, you never would, but Fred Williams, he has supported Bob Inyart live for years. Financially, thank you for that, Fred. But we need help, and if you could help, please help us. 800-8-NYART. Have you seen the Bob and Yurt Live catalog? It's got so many neat resources, like videos such as Get Out of the Matrix, when I debated a college philosophy class, and Eagle Eggs, when does an eagle become an eagle? Mount Moriah, the evidence for the resurrection, and God and the death penalty. So call in and ask for the Bob and Yurt Live catalog, or get it on the web at kgov.com. Of course, all these materials are listed and described on the internet, or call us at 800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. 800-8-NYART. So give us a ring.